Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Republican lawmakers approved a slate of COVID-19 bills that would give themselves a say over the use of federal relief funds and ban vaccine mandates for the virus. An assembly committee now has the power to subpoena witnesses as it looks into how recent elections have been administered. And the Senate's Republican leader says his caucus won't agree to again waive the one-week waiting period for receiving unemployment benefits. Rewind, your week in review for March 26th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, the legislature approved a slate of COVID-19 measures. Lawmakers passed Republican-led bills to bar state and local health officials from requiring vaccinations, require Governor Tony Evers to create a plan for all state employees to return to work in person, prevent health officials from barring gatherings in places of worship, and another bill to give themselves oversight over federal relief dollars. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss threatened to sue if Governor Evers were to veto that particular bill, which Evers has already pledged to do. Voss on the assembly floor this week said, quote, "We will have no choice but to go to court." Many of these proposals were part of a broader COVID bill that Governor Evers vetoed last month. We'll talk more about the federal money from the American Rescue Plan and Wisconsin's share of it in the next topic. But JR, how do you see this power struggle playing out over the control of this money over the next couple months?
Well, a couple of questions that I have. One, how quickly can Governor Evers get that money out the door? We have to worry about a court saying there's got to be any oversight by lawmakers. And two, what's the law really say? Because I asked the Fiscal Bureau about this, and generally speaking, under state law that's been in place for a while, when we get federal money, and except in certain circumstances, the administration has the opportunity to spend it. Like it's that's kind of the power that it has. And back last year, when Republicans were trying to kind of put pressure on Evers about how to spend the initial package of federal COVID money, they wrote a letter in which they said explicitly, you have the sole power to spend this. So obviously we've gone now through, this is the third round of stimulus money from the federal government. It's a much bigger package, a much, much bigger package. And, you know, Republicans are trying to get some say in how this money is spent. It is unique in Wisconsin to see somebody, one person, have the power to spend this many billions of dollars. But also in talking to Democrats, they pointed out that Governor Evers has no real interest, or say, Governor Evers has no reason to trust Republicans as a partner in how to spend COVID money because they don't have trust of each other at all. I mean, this is a broken relationship. It has been for a long time between Robin Voss and Tony Evers. Devin Lemon, who's a new player to that relationship. Remember, Scott Fitzgerald had his position before, but there's not a trust factor there to work together. And I just don't see the governor right now, at least talking to people I've talked to, they don't see him saying, okay, you guys come on in, let's share this authority, and I'll sign that bill.
Right. There's also a question from critics right now that's, why are they threatening to sue at this point? You know, we've seen a lot of federal money coming in, the CARES Act, you know, other federal relief bills, but this is the first time that they've explicitly, you know, in this manner said, we will sue you if this doesn't come to pass, if this doesn't play out in our favor. Also, another question I've heard this week is, would Republicans try to hold up this money for 2 years in the hope that a new administration comes in and they're able to spend it under maybe a Republican governor? That's another question floating around. But a lot of this could very well impact the budget. That's something that we'll get into in our next topic. JR, anything you want to add on that before we hear from Speaker Voss?
No, I'm just curious. You know, is the way I read through the bill, I think in some pots of money, and there are a lot of pots of money, they had to be spent through, like, I think the end of 2023 or 2024. So there is some time to kind of spread this out. So, yeah, I mean, if there's a delay, you'd have somebody else at the helm for some of that money. Maybe that's part of the motivation. But, you know, it's also supposed to kind of help put a jolt in the economy. So it's going to be interesting to watch how Evers tries to push this money out the door. Because with the CARES Act money that came down last spring, he got pressure because a lot of it had been allocated but actually spent toward the end of last year. So there's kind of like this push to get it out. So now how's he going to approach getting that money out the door with this lawsuit maybe hanging over his head?
That's right. We'll hear now from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Democratic Representative Evan Goyke, who talked about this issue on the Assembly floor on Tuesday.
The governor doesn't have the right to commit the legislature, which is the organization, the constitutional body that appropriates funds. He does not have the right to put us on the hook with the federal government unilaterally. Because don't forget, this money has 4 years to be spent. 4 years. That means when Governor Evers is replaced in January of 2023, whoever that Republican governor is to choose can give all the money to causes that they care about. You wouldn't even know where it was going until the money was already spent. This is the single most important bill that we are going to take up in this floor period. Nothing is more important than making sure that transparency, openness, good government is protected. If you choose to vote no, it will basically be saying, what's the point of having a legislature? If a governor has the ability to commit all the funds, to commit a future legislature, to commit us to certain policy positions, whether we agree with them or not, you are abdicating your constitutional duty to stand up and do what I think we should all rally around, which is to have the legislature be at least a co-equal branch.
I think Republicans now suffer from the Tony Evers fever. And I know because I once suffered from Walker derangement system syndrome. It gets a little cloudy in the haze. You got to break free of it. The gentleman from the 63rd said that this vote, this bill, was the most important thing we do today. And then the speaker, the gentleman from the 63rd, went on about how this bill has a robust process, increases transparency, openness, and good government. Let me tell you, the 14-day passive review process of the Joint Committee on Finance is not an open and transparent process, and it is not a model of good government. So we've heard questions about what is our responsibility and the role of legislators on this floor, abdicating responsibility. My responsibility to the 57,000 people that elected me is to help them the best I can in getting through one of the most difficult, unprecedented, and uncertain times. It is my responsibility to help them get that relief and not have that relief delayed.
Wisconsin is set to receive an estimated $8.7 billion from the latest COVID package. That figure, which was based on an estimate the Legislative Fiscal Bureau compiled for WisPolitics.com, is based on anticipated aid to state and local governments and schools. So it's not a complete estimate. It doesn't include things like the federal Medicaid expansion dollars that Wisconsin could theoretically accept. Breaking down these numbers further, though, the state's expected to get $3.2 billion directly through the state fiscal recovery fund. Local governments are expected to receive an estimated $2.14 billion from the local fiscal recovery fund. That includes $1 billion for counties, $787 million for metropolitan cities like Milwaukee and Madison, and $399 million for other cities, towns, and villages. Those funds can be used to cover costs incurred before the end of 2024. There's also the expected school spending will run through $1.5 billion for public K-12 schools, $67 million for private schools, and $560 million for colleges and universities. The big thing to note here, though, is for that state fiscal recovery fund money, that can't be spent to reduce taxes. Ohio has already sued the Biden administration over that provision. The decision there could certainly impact what we do here in Wisconsin. We're still waiting for more guidelines as well from the U.S. Treasury Department over how to spend this money. We know Evers' budget didn't take this money into account. JR, how do you anticipate these dollars influencing that process?
Well, a couple of things. So one, with the pots of money in the Fiscal Bureau memo, we asked them to kind of give us a rough estimate because there's just so much, but they didn't really give us a central figure. And so they kind of did a best guess of adding everything together. And the caveat is that the state has to apply for some of that money. For example, there's this capital projects fund, and the state could qualify for up to about $189 million for a capital project if it applied and the formula that's been laid out works. Because the Treasury Department has until, like, I think the next month and a half to lay out that process, the application process. We don't know for sure we'll get it, but if everything goes as it's supposed to, we would. Well, then there's a capital budget, right? Lawmakers have already signaled that they don't want to do the $2.4 billion Evers wants. Well, there's a pot of money that can be used for a project without taking out more bonding. Now, Caveats are the legislature has to enumerate a building project in Wisconsin. The building commission has to sign off on something. So there would still have to be some legislative input there in that pot of money. But there are other things like everything from child care grants. I mean, this pot of money coming in is massive, and it cuts across all kinds of sectors. Looking just at like Milwaukee, for example, the city, like you mentioned, the city gets 400 million or so, the county 180 some million. Looking at the school district, we've already seen the Milwaukee school district in the last round of federal aid, which is round two, get about 225 million. Now this pot of money is more than twice as big. It's almost three times as big as that last round. Now, I haven't seen the formula yet of how that money will be divvied up, but a lot of this money's been going through, it's called a Title I formula, which is basically a formula based off of how many children in poverty you have in your district. If that formula is used for the bulk of that money, you're talking Milwaukee Public Schools could see a huge influx of cash. The question that people have that I've talked to is, can government leaders in Wisconsin, are they up to the task of being possibly transformative? If you think about that money for Milwaukee alone, we're talking maybe $1 billion combined, maybe even more, between the city, the county, and the school district. What could Milwaukee do with $1 billion? Can they think transformative? Because that's really the opportunity that some communities are going to have with this money. Now, the smaller towns in Wisconsin, they're, you know, you're talking maybe you can pave a half-mile road, right? It's not going to be a whole lot. But there's still a little bit of something for everybody in this package, and the amount of money is just, it's mind-boggling sometimes to think, you know, $8.7 billion when our entire budget for 2 years is 90-some billion dollars in Wisconsin, at least what Evers proposed for the next two-year period.
Yeah, part of me is wondering, is this money almost an incentive to not get a budget done very quickly, right? We know this money will have an impact, but we're also still waiting for Treasury guidelines. There's a lot of other unknowns tied to these dollars. One thing that also stands out to me is these relief funds, at least the state and county ones, extend beyond the life of our next budget cycle, 21-23. Will the state create a budget that attempts to use all of this money? Will lawmakers try to keep some funds left over, right, if they have purview over those dollars? That gets back to our first topic. But there's a lot of different factors that play into this. Do you have any thoughts about that, JR?
Well, don't forget, too, the local money, that can be used for tax cuts. So the state money can, but Fiscal Bureau pointed out that the locals could use this money for a tax cut. So might see some use it for that. I mean, it's just a question of what kind of hole did you get into during the pandemic that you might need to kind of climb out of with this money. And as far as how the budget's impacted, I mean, I've already heard from lawmakers, like, looking at the money Milwaukee's gotten for its public schools. And so they're kind of going and rolling, like, okay, why should we put that much more state dollars into MPS, which hasn't been really doing in-person instruction yet, if they're getting all this federal money? What they don't know is how could they structure something with state aid that would then reward districts that have been in-person? Because remember, the governor has a very broad partial veto authority. So he could rework, if they want to do, for example, they call it categorical aid, where you give districts a pot of money for a certain specific purpose. If you made a pot of money for in-person instruction, Evers could rework that possibly as a veto pen. So there's lots of trickiness to how you might do this. The big overwhelming or overarching question, I should say, is how does this impact getting a deal between Republican lawmakers and the governor? You could see a scenario in which Republicans approve a budget that isn't what Evers wants, and that Evers could maybe veto. Then Republicans go, well, hey, you've got all this money anyway, so what's the point of doing another budget? We're going to go ahead and let this extra cash coming in. Our tax collection should go up in the next 2 years, according to projections. We're going to let that cash come in, and we're going to see who the next governor is. Maybe we'll do something different with it after that next governor comes in. So I'm not saying they won't get a budget done, and there's talk almost every couple of years about how, oh, they'll never get it done this time. But it might kind of play into the whole dynamic about what kind of budget Republicans produce, and does Evers sign it no matter what, or is this a way to kind of maybe have an extra incentive to say, hey, I could really veto this thing and still do a whole lot of good stuff that I want to do, i.e. the governor, with this federal money.
It's worth noting, though, that Evers and Republicans under this administration are one for one in getting a budget done. So
yes,
maybe
right.
They'll keep up that success rate going forward. But also, I'm looking to see, will Republicans in the legislature be united in whatever they decide to do on this front? We've seen some fracture, some settling in at the very beginning of this session. what would that look like in the next couple of months. But anyway, we've got to move on now, unless you want to add something quick.
I was going to say real quick, that came into the whole debate about the oversight bill that Republicans approved this week, in that John Mertenbach, a Democrat kind of from Western Dane County, said, hey, the two chambers, the Republicans haven't been on the same page in everything so far this session. So how can you promise us you'll be on the same page about oversight of this money if you can't be on the same page about X, Y, and Z already? So just another dynamic for the governor to consider and when he likely vetoes that bill.
An important one to watch. This week, the Assembly also cleared the way for its elections panel to subpoena witnesses. The Assembly approved a resolution along a party line vote, 58 to 35, to officially direct the Campaigns and Elections Committee to investigate how elections have been conducted in Wisconsin dating back to the beginning of 2019. The panel has already held two informational hearings focused on the November 2020 election. This vote allows the committee to issue subpoenas, as I mentioned above, to compel testimony and review records. The last time a legislative committee issued a subpoena was more than 50 years ago, according to the Legislative Reference Bureau. The two hearings that have been held by this committee have included invited speakers, so public testimony has been very limited, very restricted in who has been able to offer testimony at these so far. Representative Joe Sanfilippo, the vice chair of the committee, said this week that he hopes lawmakers on that panel will never have to use their subpoena power. JR, do you buy that?
I can guess that they hope not to use it. I'm not sure I believe that they will not be willing to use it. And part of that is because for example, Green Bay is now the latest hot spot about election, how it was run in November. And, you know, will the Green Bay mayor, Eric Genrich, a former Democratic lawmaker, would he come down to Madison and testify in front of this committee when it's been a partisan endeavor so far? If he refuses, then what's going to happen, right? So that's what I'm kind of watching. Plus, too, you know, this committee, it has not had a lot of Democratic buy-in. Part of it is because the two parties are just on opposite ends of the spectrum, period. But really on this one, you couldn't get farther apart about how the election was run last fall and what should be done about it. So Dems, I don't think, are going to want to, in their minds, legitimize the process by participating. But, you know, maybe they will in some way. But if they do participate, they're going to continually bring up that this is not right in their minds.
Right. And what's the broader plan for this committee, right? Assembly Speaker Voss, immediately following the November election, called on this committee to begin an investigation. There was a delay. A hearing was held in December, I believe. A few months later, another hearing is held. Right now, we have one scheduled for next week. But what is actually the broader Assembly Republican Caucus's vision for what this committee is supposed to do, especially now that it does have this subpoena power?
And don't forget, we've got a dozen bills already introduced that propose various changes to election laws in Wisconsin. The Audit Bureau is conducting its review. When I talked to Robin Voss a couple weeks ago, he indicated that there might be a wave of bills from the Assembly sometime this spring, maybe after the committee does a little bit of work. But then they'll see the audit comes in, which the audit probably won't be done until the fall sometime. Then there could be kind of like part two of these bills once that audit identifies any issues that Republicans want to dive into.
That's right. Let's hear now from Representative Sanfilippo and Assembly Democratic Representative Lee Snodgrass, who talked about this issue prior to the floor vote on Tuesday.
Over the past year and a half, we've heard allegations of improprieties being done, specifically state laws on the books not being followed. So this resolution lays the foundation so that going forward, as our committee investigates the administration of our elections, should we determine that a need arises where we need to subpoena people or documents, we're laying the groundwork for being able to do that according to state statutes. It's my hope that we never even have to use this process, because I think it's in everybody's best interest to be open and forthcoming on how our elections are administered throughout the state. I can't honestly see why anybody would not want to answer questions or provide documentation, but this just gives us the necessary tools we need to go forward.
Across the state, audits, recounts, official canvasses, and court cases have all confirmed that our elections have been fair and transparent. Republican-led resolutions like this one are undermining public faith in elections and attacking the integrity of the process. The poll workers, the members of the Wisconsin National Guard, even, all who worked hard to administer a safe, secure, and transparent election in spite of a global pandemic. Where Republican legislators have resorted to fear-mongering and strategies to cast doubt, the reality is that the majority of people have not lost faith in the integrity of American elections. They have lost faith in the integrity of the Republican Party. You know what the most effective way to restore confidence in the integrity of our elections is? Tell the truth.
Senate Republicans aren't planning to again waive the one-week waiting period for unemployment benefits. Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu told WisPolitics.com this week his caucus won't continue this suspension because it would, quote, incentivize people not to get back to work. Wisconsin would need to extend it to qualify for federal matching money under the latest COVID package. The law covers all the costs tied to the first week of unemployment for states that have suspended that waiting period. Senate Minority Leader Jenna Buley reacted, saying 1 week of wages is a lot to many, many people who live literally from paycheck to paycheck. Republicans first put the waiting period in place in the 2011-13 budget. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said last week he's more worried about, quote, creating a disincentive to work with the federal UI unemployment insurance expansion than with again suspending the waiting period. Asked about the issue this week, Voss said they would, the Assembly Republicans, would caucus on it. JR, any sense of where that caucus is at on this issue?
Well, once LeMahieu said that the Senate Republicans weren't going to do it, they pretty much put a kibosh on anything happening. But two, we already kind of had hints from Voss with his concerns about the extension as well, or keeping it, the extending the suspension going. Because remember, unemployment now, we just got out Thursday that is at 3.8% again for a second month in a row. We're getting close to pre-pandemic levels, and the word you're hearing from Republicans is that they're getting word from their employers in their districts that they're having a hard time finding bodies again to fill jobs. So to them, this is not what they want, the direction they want to go. They're feeling like the economy is getting back on its feet, and they want to encourage people to get back into the workforce. The pushback from Democrats is, you know, the argument from Robin Voss that there's kind of a disincentive to go get a job because you're getting a $14 stimulus check and a little bit extra unemployment is a little tone deaf with the hole that some people have put in during this pandemic. So I just don't know if there's going to be any real political consequences for Republicans about not doing the suspension of the 1 week, or extending the 1 week suspension at this point. I just don't know if that's going to be an issue for them come next fall.
Can the Department of Workforce Development sort of, you know, go forward with promulgating a rule to extend this suspension? Or I know that they tried that, the administration tried that at one point last year, but I'm not sure if that's an avenue that the Evers administration could take this time around.
It doesn't look like one that would be successful if challenged in court. So yes, they tried that approach a little bit earlier on, but Republican lawmakers already indicated they think that's illegal and that they would take steps to undercut that if they tried doing something like that.
All right, moving on now to our COVID update this week. The Department of Health Services has warned of a recent uptick in COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin as neighboring states Michigan and Minnesota reported a jump in infection rates. In Wisconsin, the state this week recorded its highest seven-day average since March 5th. Officials are also cautioning against traveling and engaging in other risky behaviors. More than one-fourth of Wisconsinites 16 and up have received at least one dose of the vaccine, and officials this week announced that the state's fourth community-based vaccination clinic will open on April 6th in Wausau. Also this week, something worth highlighting, Republican legislative leaders applauded the Evers administration's process for distributing COVID-19 vaccine. Rare praise for Evers and the Department of Health Services. What did you make of those comments, JR?
A little stunned silence. Wasn't expecting that one this week, so... But I mean, you know, this was a weak spot for the governor's administration about a month ago, or 2 months ago, I should say. We're one of the worst in the nation for getting shots in arms. Now we're one of the best. But remember that Republicans in talking about this and the praise of the governor are also talking about the context of getting back to quote unquote normal and wanting, you know, pushing employers to kind of get things going again, getting kind of back to normal by July 4th. So they're trying to send a message of normalcy and throughout the state that we're back kind of a quote unquote open economy by the summer.
Mm-hmm. Also worth noting that, you know, Republicans have been butting heads with the Evers administration throughout the entire course of this pandemic, right? They took the Evers administration to court last spring over the Safer at Home order. You know, they just recently voted down the mask mandate extension. Anyway, we'll keep following this issue. But let's hear now from Department of Health Services Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke on the COVID variants we're seeing in Wisconsin.
We have 69 reported identified cases of the UK variant and one of the South African variant. But we also know a number of states in the nation are seeing significant upticks in cases and identified cases of variants, including our neighbors in Minnesota and Michigan. We know that these variants are particularly infectious, and we're seeing in other places younger people suffering from higher levels of infection. We have come down from an extremely critically uber high level of over 6,000 cases a day to the level we're at today. So I think in a way, we've been lulled into a sense of security here in Wisconsin because we had it so bad that just having it bad doesn't seem too awful to us. So that goes to my answer to Rob's question too about why I would caution travel right now. We don't want to bring more variants into Wisconsin.
Let's move on to stock picks. JR, what's rising this week?
Ho-Chunk Nation. This week, Governor Evers signed off on in a key step for the tribe building a casino in Beloit. Remember, it was just 6 years ago that the last proposal for a new casino was shot down by then-Governor Scott Walker. The two big differences I heard about this project versus last time was, one, the Forest County Potawatomi backed the Beloit proposal by the Ho-Chunk, and number two, Scott Walker's presidential ambitions weren't playing a role in the decision. Remember, Scott Walker put the nix on the Menominee proposal in Kenosha, about an $800 million complex, just before going to talk to a bunch of Iowa evangelicals in 2015 as he looked at running for president. Those folks would have been happy with Scott Walker if he had expanded gaming ahead of running for president. Now the governor at the time insisted politics wasn't a wrong decision, but others have some doubts about that. But two, with the Potawatomi, the one, the Beloit Casino probably will cut in a little bit to what the Potawatomi has, its flagship operation in Milwaukee. But there's this thing with tribes about ancestral lands and territorial lands, treaty lands. So for the Potawatomi, they opposed the Menominee. Yes, it would have cut into what Forest County Potawatomi were taking at Milwaukee, but also that land that there was proposed for that casino had been in a treaty with the Potawatomi U.S. government. Now the government broke that treaty, like it broke a lot of treaties with tribes years and years ago. But there's a real sensitivity among tribes about doing stuff like that. The Ho-Chunk, meanwhile, the land that they're looking at in Beloit, that's part of their kind of territory that's theirs. There's no dispute about that. It's a much different situation with the tribes in that regard. It's also a case of the wealthiest tribes getting wealthier, because the Forest County Potawatomi and the Ho-Chunk are the two wealthiest tribes in the state and have some of the best gaming operations. And the Ho-Chunk now will have a line from the state line with the final two steps are completed of Beloit, Madison, and Wisconsin Dells, all along I-90.
Hmm. All right, JR, what's mixed this week?
Department of Health Services. So we kind of touched this last week, and I kind of got curious about this whole thing about the underreporting of deaths at nursing homes. And the line for Republicans has become that, you know, Evers is the Andrew Cuomo of the Midwest. I asked some of my best healthcare sources this past week. They said that is over the top and not at all accurate. Same time, it doesn't mean they did everything right at DHS. There's still some maybe a deep dive you do with open records requests about why these things weren't properly recorded originally. Now, the question is becoming now, did the Evers administration change its approach to nursing homes because there weren't as many deaths reported as there should have been or could have been? The answer from the Evers folks has been no, that cases, not deaths, trigger investigations at nursing homes about outbreaks. The governor said it had played no role in the decisions. And beyond nursing homes, nobody I talked to thinks that Governor Evers would have done any differently about the stay-at-home mandates or the mask mandates if we had reported more nursing home deaths at the time. So that said, there might be a little bit something there if more Republicans are to poke into the next, you know, couple months.
And falling.
Josh Call, and it's not as much about the Attorney General as maybe the Supreme Court's getting original action fatigue. And what I mean by that is Josh Call asked State Supreme Court to take original action, a lawsuit he filed seeking to overturn parts of the 2018 lame duck laws that gave the Joint Finance Committee oversight of settlements that his Department of Justice tries to reach. Now, the court had weighed on this a little bit before last year, but it made clear it wasn't doing a separation of powers decision in its ruling, okay? So Call went back with what's called original action, basically asking the court to take the case directly, not going to the lower courts first. At one time, that was rare. There's a professor at Marquette who tracks stats with the Supreme Court. I believe prior to the 2019-20 court session, there were two original actions accepted by the court in like a 15-year period. There were five in the last session. And that's not how things normally go, because the way it works is the circuit court acts to develop the record, flush things out. The appeals court, you know, finds holes that maybe the circuit court missed. and the Supreme Court gets a kind of well-documented case before it to kind of dive into, it's been acting as a court of a first resort a lot of times in the last year about big issues. Noteworthy in this that there was no dissent in not taking the case. It's a separation of powers issue. Conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley, that is right in her wheelhouse. So the fact that she didn't dissent tells us that maybe this is a sign the courts want to get back to, okay, let's go normal process going forward. Plus, two, there's not a burning controversy right now. Remember, there was a big standoff between Call and the Joint Finance Committee in 2019 about this whole submitting settlements. We haven't had a big standoff in the last year. The Joint Finance Committee signed off on like four settlements in February or March, I believe it was. And otherwise, Call has found ways to go around the committee saying, hey, this settlement doesn't reach the standards in the law, so we don't need approval from Joint Finance. And Joint Finance hasn't challenged them on it. So unless there's a big controversy, maybe we'll have to see this go through the lower courts first.
Thanks, JR, and thanks everyone for watching. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind, your week in review for March 26th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.